I assume you've seen some of the reports or responses to reports about the Tonga and Samoan league game over the weekend, or last weekend, whenever it was. What were your responses when you saw some of that reporting, but also the comments in response to those?
It's really interesting the way the media responds to what happened with the Tongan Samoa situation with the league, and how they would cover something like the America's Cup, for example. So, you know, when you see crowds going crazy over other sporting events, you know, the headlines are, you know, scenes of jubilation, you know, Aucklanders, you know, celebrate on the streets. Those are the types of headlines you see. And the and if there is violence, and often there is, those are secondary in the story. It's very much focused on the positive, and then which is unusual in the media. But in those cases, you do see it. And if there are, you know, fights, then they're treated as they are. You know, silly individuals who take it too far, and there's some fisticuffs, and it's given an appropriate sort of treatment within the story. When it comes to those same sorts of issues, but within a Māori or Pacifica community in New Zealand, then it's like the article is almost reversed, and it. And very much it's the headlines are centred around, you know, the actions of a couple of or several individuals, and there's some sort of mass generalisations rather than it being, you know, flipped up as it was in the other article. So it's quite interesting the difference in how those groups are treated.
This is, I mean, it's there. That sort of racialized language is quite particular to sport, given the kind of stereotypical treatment of Māori and Pacific when it comes to sport. But this sort of sensational and racialized language, it happens in reporting in all sort of issues of society. What are the implications of that sort of language?
Well, what it does is it gives people who may have a natural inclination to be racist or discriminatory, it gives them a sense of having a moral high ground on which to hold those opinions. So it really reinforces people's ideas around those communities and their worthiness, and how they should be treated by society. So those, you know, headlines can be incredibly damaging. And then there's also too often a narrative that follows those stories about, well, what are the community leaders of these groups doing about them? And that's not a question that we see being asked of, for example, you know, if you have some Pākehā kids, for example, committing crimes, like there was a story last year of a group of young boys in Northland that went on a bit of a spree and punched a whole lot of stuff and smashed up cars and all that sort of thing. There wasn't a big outcry afterwards about what Pākehā community leaders are doing to sort these kids out, but invariably when it comes to these sorts of issues within Māori and Pacifica communities, there is always that conversation that comes up afterwards. Well, and it's really unfair, because most of the time community leaders are doing great things that are ignored, and absolutely do take responsibility for their young ones, but we don't have that same expectation when it comes to non-Māori communities.
So is this just a continuation of certain power structures? Are people kind of, you know, ignorantly replicating that, or is there a specific kind of agenda behind it?
I think for the most part it's ignorance. And I used to think that it's ignorance, and also it's about, you know, creating clickbait and headlines that capture an audience or the attention of an audience. And I used to think that probably the best way to counteract that is to have more Māori and Pacifica and other groups within holding positions of editorial power within newsrooms, and that that would be a good way of helping to turn the tide on those sorts of that sort of coverage. And that is an important part of it, but it's actually not enough, because sometimes you do get people in those positions and they continue to perpetuate that type of thinking and that type of coverage. So really it's about, for want of a better word, decolonising the mindset of everyone that works in a newsroom, from, you know, the reporters right up through to the producers, editors, people making editorial calls, so that they become aware of the damage that they cause when they have these mass generalisations about those communities. Simply having a brown person in the seat making the calls isn't enough. Everyone needs to be responsible for the way they cover these stories.
On that point, where does the responsibility lie in terms of, if you have that sort of decolonisation happening in the newsroom, but you have such an interactive mediascape now, and people who aren't trained journalists or people who don't have that responsibility can go on and can have a platform and say whatever they want?
So do you mean in terms of like the comment section of those
Definitely.
Sorts of stories? Yeah, that's a tough one, and it's, you know, it's changing all the time, and it's really interesting because, you know, for the Hui, we have our own Facebook page, but we're a part of TV3 and News Hub, and News Hub has their own Facebook page, and it's remarkable when you look at the completely polarised response that we get on our Facebook page when it comes to one of our stories compared to what happens on the News Hub website. So, for example, a couple of weeks ago, we did a story about a young man called Morocco Tai, who was 15 years old. He'd had a really unstable family background where he'd been in and out of state care, shifted around Whānau members, and ultimately ended up dying in a car accident in a stolen car he was driving. And the week before, he'd made headlines for being a passenger in a vehicle that was being driven up the wrong side of the southern motorway. Now, our story was an interview with his aunt, who wanted to provide some context to his death. You know, his death had made headlines, but people didn't really understand, you know, the reasons or the circumstances that had led to Morocco finding himself, you know, in this downward spiral on the wrong side of the law. And it was important to his aunt that people understood why he had gotten into trouble, and more importantly, that he was actually a really beautiful young man who was loved by his extended whānau, who was respectful, who loved kapa haka, who had lots of potential, and who had unfortunately fallen through the cracks of not just the welfare system, but also their whānau. And so we did this story about him, and it got posted on our Facebook page and on the News Hub Facebook page, and overwhelmingly the comments on our Facebook page were supportive and loving, and, you know, ka aroha, you know, he momo tēnei tama, you know, so sad, such a waste of a young life and potential. And by comparison, on the News Hub website, man, there is no milk of human kindness being spilt on that page. It was all, well, you know, it's good that he's dead because it means that he won't be victimising people in the future, and, you know, good riddance, and really awful, awful comments. And the thing is that that wasn't a case of people just responding to a story being treated in a really shoddy way. It was a good, insightful story, and yet people still make those horrible comments. Now, I'm not sure, you know, this is, it's new ground that everyone's still finding their feet on. it's important that there's a contest of ideas, and it's important that there's freedom of speech. But, you know, the line is, when does freedom of speech actually become, you know, a type of hate speech? And how much should we, as news platforms, allow those sorts of comments to go unchecked? You know, it can be incredibly difficult when you post a comment and you suddenly get hundreds of posts of a story and you have hundreds of comments, because it's actually really time-consuming monitoring them all. So, again, it's, you know, it's a difficult one, but I do think that that as news providers, we do have a responsibility to monitor those sorts of comments, and but at the same time to not be too heavy-handed with them. So I guess it depends on your newsroom and who's making the editorial calls and how well-resourced you are to keep on top of that sort of stuff. But, you know, I used to think that New Zealanders, by and large, were really fair-minded people, and that if they understood the context that these sorts of stories happen and that they would be reflective and perhaps more kind to others. But there's a group within New Zealand society, and they tend to be incredibly proactive on these pages, and it can be a real eye-opening and, quite frankly, disappointing experience to see the sort of stuff that those types of people come out with.
What do you think of Guy and Espiner posting up the complaints he gets about his deal use?
Wow, again, really eye-opening, isn't it? And I really like that Guy on shares those comments, because for myself personally, and probably for others who love te reo Māori and te ao Māori, sometimes we can live a little bit in a bubble, and it can be a bit shocking when you see comments like that, because we're not really dealing with people like that on a, you know, on a day-to-day basis. So I think it's really good, and it sparks a conversation about, you know, even though we've come a long way, we still have a hell of a long way to go. And I think that's why getting te reo Māori into schools is such an important thing, because to change those sorts of mindsets, you really have to start people young, and you have to naturalise the idea of the reo being a part of our society. So I think it's, I think that, you know, Guyon's bringing that sort of mindset out into the open is very helpful.
You talk about decolonisation of sort of mainstream newsrooms also. What does that entail?
I think it entails a really proactive approach by the people who run newsrooms in terms of educating their staff about the issues faced by other communities, people understanding the treaty and what it means to be mana whenua, what it means to be tangata whenua, what it means to have been colonised. I think it involves reaching out to, you know, people who are experts in that sort of field. I mean, Leonie Pihama, of course, is an outstanding example of someone who can provide a lot of insights in terms of educating people around those sorts of issues. But it absolutely has to come from the top down, and there has to be a proactive approach to doing it. Because it's not enough to just simply cherry pick a couple of brown people in your newsroom and think you've got it covered. Pākehā have to, and all ethnic groups have to understand the circumstances that has led Māori society to be in the position that it's in, and not just Māori either, but also our Pacifica cousins and others. I was talking to a friend of mine the other day who has worked within a Māori newsroom for a long time and has recently started working in a mainstream organisation. And she was talking to me about how shocking it was to listen to the sorts of conversations that happen in mainstream organisations compared to a Māori one. And the example she used was the Tēnā Porta case. And while at the, you know, within a Māori newsroom, there is no question of his deserving of compensation. In a mainstream organisation, she was saying that the conversation was how undeserving he was, and, you know, he confessed, and if you're stupid enough to do that, then, you know, you don't deserve to be compensated. So I think, you know, that's a real classic example of how differently we think from each other, and how when you work within one type of organisation, you can be cocooned, and it's really important to know how the other half think, and that goes both ways, in order to, you know, dispel some of those really damaging mindsets about Māori.